Chapter 13. The Hethanta Mountains. Even the hard-hearted avoid the heat of desperate men, for the bonfires of the weak crack the most stone. Cunryan Proverb. So who were the heroes and the cravens of the Holy War? There are already songs enough to answer that question. Needless to say, the Holy War provided further violent proof of Agensis's old proverb, though all men be equally frail before the world, the differences between them are terrifying. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, the central Jayonati steppe. Never before had Neyur endured such a trial. They traveled southeast, by and large unseen and unmolested. Before the catastrophe at Kayuth, Neyur and his kinsmen had not been able to travel more than a day without encountering parties of Manawati, Akunahor, or other Skilvendi tribes. Now, 3 or 4 days typically passed before he and Kellis were intercepted. They crossed some tribal lands without any challenge at all. At first, Neyur had dreaded the sight of galloping horsemen. Custom protected any Skilvendi warrior on pilgrimage to the Empire, and in better days, such encounters were occasions for gossip, exchanges of information, and familial greetings, a time to set aside the knife. But it was uncommon for a lone Skilvendi warrior to be accompanied by a slave, and these were not better days. In desperate times, Neyur knew, men rationed nothing so jealously as tolerance. They were more strict in their interpretation of custom and less forgiving of uncommon things. But most of the bands they encountered consisted of boys with girlish faces and sapling limbs. If the sight of Neyur's scarred arms did not awe them into stammering deference, they would posture the way juveniles do, taking pride in aping the words and manner of their dead fathers. They would nod sagely at Neyur's explanation and scowl at those who asked childish questions. Few of them had seen the Empire, so it remained a place of wonder. All of them, at some point, bid him to avenge their dead kin. Soon, Neyur found himself yearning for these encounters, for the escape they offered. The steppe unfolded before Neyur and Kellis, featureless for the most part, indifferent to the desolation between them. The pastures grew thicker and green. Purple blossoms no bigger than Neyur's fingernail bobbed in the wind, which combed the grasses into sweeping waves across the distance. His hatred dulled by boredom, Neyur would watch cloud shadows sail ponderously toward the horizon. And even though he knew they rode through the heart of the Jayonati steppe, it seemed he traveled through a stranger's land. On the 9th day of their journey, they awoke to woolen skies. It began to rain. On the steppe, the rain seemed endless. Gray encompassed every distance until it seemed they traveled through a void. The northerner turned to him, his eyes lost in the hollows beneath his brows. Tails of wet hair curled into his beard, framing his narrow face. "Tell me," Kellis said, "about Shima." Pressing, always pressing. "Shima, does Moengus truly dwell there?"
"It's holy to the Enrithi,"
Neyur replied, keeping his head bowed against the rain.
"But possessed by the Fainum."
He did not bother to raise his voice over the dreary roar. He knew the man would hear him. "How did this happen?" Neyur weighed these words carefully, as though tasting them for poison. He'd resolved to ration what he would and would not say about the three seas to the Dunyane. Who knew what weapons the man might fashion?
"The Fainum," he replied warily, "have made it their mission to destroy the Tusk in Sumna. They've warred for many years against the Empire. Shima is but one of many prizes."
"Do you know these Fainum well?"
"Well enough. 8 years ago I led the Utumot against them at Zirkirta, far to the south of here."
The Dunyane nodded. "Your wives told me you were unconquered on the field of battle."
"Anissi, did you tell him this?"
He could see her betraying him in innumerable ways, thinking she spoke in his interest. Nayur turned his face away, watched the grasses resolve from the gray. Such comments, he knew, were simply plays on his vanity. He no longer responded to anything remotely intimate. Kellis returned to his earlier tack. You said the Phanum seek to destroy the Tusk? What is the Tusk? The question shocked Nayur. Even the most ignorant of his cousins knew of the Tusk. Perhaps he simply tested his answers against those of others.
The first scripture of men, he said to the rain. There was a time, before the birth of Lokang, when even the people were bound by the Tusk.
Your god was born?
Yes, a long time ago. It was our god who laid waste to the northern lands and gave them to the Shrank.
He tipped his head back and, for a moment, savored the break of cold water across his forehead and face. It tasted sweet on his lips. He could feel the Dunyane watching, scrutinizing his profile.
What do you see?
What of the Phanum? Kellis asked.
What of them?
Will they hinder our passage through their land? Nayor suppressed the urge to look at the man. Either intentionally or inadvertently, Kellis had struck upon an issue that had troubled him ever since he'd resolved to undertake this quest. That day, so long ago it now seemed, hiding among the dead at Kaiuth, Nayor had heard Ikuri Confis speak of an Inrithi holy war. But a holy war against whom? The schools or the Phanum? Nayor had chosen their path carefully. He intended to cross the Hathanta Mountains into the Empire, even though a lone Skilvendi could not expect to live long among the Nansur. It would have been better to avoid the Empire altogether, to travel due south to the headwaters of the River Sempis, which they could have followed directly into Shigek, the northernmost governorate of Kian. From there, they simply could have followed the traditional pilgrimage routes to Shima. The Phanum were rumored to be surprisingly tolerant of pilgrims. But if the Inrithi were in fact mounting a holy war against Kian, this route would have proven disastrous, for Kellis especially, with his fair hair and pale skin. No, he needed somehow to learn more about this holy war before striking true south, and the nearer they traveled to the Empire, the greater the probability of happening across that intelligence became. If the Inrithi didn't wage holy war against the Phanum, they could skirt the edges of the Empire and reach Phanum lands unscathed. If they did wage holy war, however, they would likely be forced to cross the Nansurium, a prospect that Nayor dreaded.
The Phanum are a warlike people,
Nayor finally replied, using the rain as a weak excuse not to look at the man.
But I'm told that they're tolerant of pilgrims.
He took care not to glance or to speak to Kellis for some time after, though something inner grimaced all the while. The more he avoided looking at the man, the more dreadful he seemed to become, the more godlike. What do you see? Nayor pinched images of Banut from his eyes. The rain lasted another day before trailing into a drizzle that veiled faraway slopes with sheets of mist. Another day passed before their wool and leather dried. Not long after, Nayor became obsessed with the thought of murdering the Dunyane in his sleep. They'd been discussing sorcery, far and away the most frequent theme of their rare discussions. The Dunyane continually returned to the subject, even telling Nayor of a defeat he'd suffered at the hands of a non-man warrior Magi far to the north. At first, Nayor assumed this preoccupation stemmed from some fear on the man's part, as though sorcery were the one thing his dogma could not digest. But then it occurred to him that Kellis knew he thought talk of sorcery harmless, and so used it to broach the silence in the hope of steering him toward more useful topics. Even the story of the non-man, Nayor realized, was likely another lie. A false confession meant to draw him into an exchange of confessions. After recognizing this latest treachery, he unaccountably thought,
When he falls asleep, I'll kill him tonight when he falls asleep.
And he continued to think this, even though he knew he could not murder the man. He knew only that Moengus had summoned Kellis to Shima, nothing more. It was unlikely he would ever find him without Kellis. Regardless, the following night he slipped from his blankets and crept across the cold turf with his broadsword. He paused next to the embers of their fire, staring at the man's inert form. Even breaths, his face as calm at night as it was impassive by day. Was he awake? What manner of man are you? Like a bored child, Nayor combed the tips of the surrounding grass with his sword's edge, watching the stalks bend, then spring upright in the moonlight. Scenarios flashed through his soul's eye, his strike stilled by Kellis's bare palms, his strike stilled by the treachery of his own hand, Kellis's eyes popping open, and a voice from nowhere saying, I know you, Skilvendi, better than any lover, any god. He crouched, poised over the man for what seemed a long while. Then, seized by paroxysms of self-doubt and fury, he crawled back to his blankets. He shivered for a long time, as though cold. Over the next 2 weeks, the great tablelands of the Jayonati interior gradually transformed into a jumble of broken inclines. The ground became loamy, and the grasses surged to sweep the flanks of their horses. Bees scribbled across the near distances, and great clouds of gnats assailed them when they splattered across stagnant waters. With each day, however, the season seemed to retreat. The ground became more stony, the grasses shorter and paler, and the insects more lethargic. We're climbing, Kellis noted. Even though the terrain had alerted Nayor to their approach, Kellis glimpsed the Hathanta Mountains across the horizon first. As always, when sighting the mountains, Nayor could feel the empire on the far side, a labyrinth of luxuriant gardens, sprawling fields, and ancient hoary cities. In the past, the Nansorium had been the destination of his tribe's seasonal pilgrimages, a place of shouting men, burning villas, and shrieking women, a place of retribution and worship. But this time, Nayor realized, the empire would be an obstacle, perhaps an insurmountable one. They had encountered no one who knew of the Holy War, and it looked as though they would be forced to cross the Hathantas and enter the empire. When he sighted the first Yaksh in the distance, he was heartened far more than was manly. As far as he could tell, they rode through Akunahor land. If anyone knew whether the empire waged holy war against Kian, it would be the Akunahor, who were the sieve through which a great many pilgrimages passed. Without a word, he yanked his horse toward the encampment. Kellis was the first to see that something was amiss. This camp, he said tonelessly, is dead. The Dunyain was right, Nayor realized. He could see several dozen Yaksh, but no people, and, more significantly, no livestock. The pasture they rode over was uncropped, and the encampment itself had the empty, dried-out look of abandoned things. His elation faded into disgust. No plain men, no plain talk, no escape. What happened? Kellis asked. Nayor spat across the grasses. He knew what had happened. After the disaster at Cayuth, the Nansor had ranged all across this land. Some detachment had come across this camp and butchered or enslaved everyone. Akunahor. Zunarit had been Akunahor. Perhaps his whole tribe had been obliterated. Aikuri Konfus, Nayor said, faintly shocked by how unimportant that name had become to him. The Emperor's nephew did this. How can you be sure? Kellis asked. Perhaps the inhabitants no longer needed this place. Nayor shrugged, knowing this was not the case. Though places on the steppe could be discarded, things could not be, not by the people, at least. Everything was needed. Then, with unaccountable certainty, he realized that Kellis would kill him. The mountains were looming, and the steppe swept out behind them. Behind them. The son of Moengus no longer needed him. He'll kill me while I sleep. No. Such a thing could not happen. Not after traveling so far, after enduring so much. He must use the son to find the father. It was the only way. We must cross the Hathantas, he declared, pretending to survey the desolate yaksh.
They look formidable, Kellis replied. They are, but I know the shortest way.
That night they camped among the abandoned yaksh. Nayor rebuffed Kellis's every attempt to draw him into conversation, listening instead to the howl of mountain wolves on the wind and jerking his head to the click and creak of the empty yaksh about them. He had struck a bargain with the Dunyane, freedom and safe passage across the steppe in return for his father's life. Now, with the steppe almost behind them, it seemed he had always known the bargain was a sham. How could he not? Was not Kellis the son of Moengus? And why had he decided to cross the mountains? Was it truly to discover whether the Empire was embroiled in a holy war, or was it to draw out the lie he had been chasing? Use the sun. Use a Dunyane. Such a fool. He did not sleep that night. Neither did the wolves. Before dawn, he crept into the pitch black of a yaksh and huddled among weeds. He found an infant skull and wept, screamed at the bindings, at the wood, at the hide surfaces. He beat his fists against the treacherous earth beneath. The wolves laughed and wailed despicable names, hateful names. Afterward, he put his lips to the earth and breathed. He could feel him listening from somewhere out there. He could feel him knowing. What did he see? It did not matter. The fire burned and it had to be fed, on lies if need be, because the fire burned true, the fire alone. So cold against swollen eyes. The steppe. The trackless steppe. They left the deserted camp at dawn, their horses trotting through grasses pocked here and there by patches of rotten leather and bone. Neither man spoke. The Hethantus climbed into the eastern sky. The slopes grew steeper, and they followed winding ridgelines in order to conserve their horses. By midday, they found themselves deep in the foothills. As always, Nayor found the change in terrain unsettling, as though the years had tattooed linear horizons and vast bowl skies onto his heart. In the hills, anything or anyone might be concealed. In the hills, one must find summits to see. Dunyane country, he thought. As though to confirm these ruminations, the heights of the next crest revealed some 20 or so riders in the distance, filing down the same trail they followed into the mountains. More Skilvendi, Kellis remarked.
Yes, returning from a pilgrimage. Would they know about the Holy War?
What tribe? Kellis asked. The question provoked Nayor's suspicion. It was too Skilvendi for an outlander.
We shall see.
Whoever the riders were, they were as concerned as he was at the sudden appearance of strangers. A handful broke into a gallop toward them, while the rest herded together what appeared to be a group of captives. He studied them as they neared, looking for the telltale signs that would identify their tribe. He realized quite quickly that they were men rather than boys, but none of them wore Kianine battle caps, which meant they were too young to have fought the Fainim at Zerkerta. Then he saw the white paint streaking their hair. They were Manuati. Images from Kaiuth assailed him, thousands of Manuati racing across smoking plains into the sorcerous fires of the Imperial Sake. Somehow these men had survived. Nayor needed only a glimpse of their leader to know he would not like the man. Even from a distance, he projected a restless arrogance. Of course, the Dunyane saw as much and more. The one in the lead, he warned, sees us as an opportunity to prove himself.
I know. Say nothing.
The strangers reined to a raucous halt before them. Nayor noticed the several fresh-cut swazand on their arms.
I am Pantaruth Urs Mutkies of the Munawati, the leader declared. Who are you?
His six kinsmen jostled behind him, watching with an air of scarcely bridled banditry.
Nayor Us Kiotha. Of the Otamot?
Pantaruth studied them, dubiously eyeing the swazand bridling Nayor's arms, then glaring at Kellis. He spat in Skilvendi fashion.
Who's this? Your slave? He is my slave, yes. You allow him weapons? He was born to my tribe. I thought it prudent. The steppe has grown desperate. That it has, Pantaruth snapped. What say you, slave? Were you born to the Utemat? The presumption stunned Neyur. You doubt my word? The steppe has grown desperate, as you say, Utemat, and there has been talk of spies. Neyur snorted. Spies? How else could the Nansor overcome us? By wits, by strength of arms, by guile? I was at Kayuth, stripling. What happened had nothing to do with... I too was at Kayuth, but I saw could be explained only by treachery. There was no mistaking the tone, the willful affront-taking of someone who wanted to spill blood. Neyur's limbs began to tingle. He glanced at Kellis, knowing the Dunyane would take everything he needed from his expression. Then he turned back to the Munawati. Do you know who I am? He said, not just to Pantaruth, but to his men as well. This seemed to shock the young warrior, but he recovered quickly.
We've heard the stories. There's not a man on this steppe who hasn't laughed at the name of Neyur Uz-Skiota.
Neyur cuffed him hard about the side of his head. A mad instant, then scrambling violence. Neyur spurred into Pantaruth, struck him a second time with his fist, knocking him from his saddle. Then he yanked his horse to the right, away from the man's stunned compatriots, drawing his broadsword. When the others spurred after him, reaching for their own weapons, he jerked his horse back into their midst and cut two down before they'd cleared their blades. He ducked a sweeping cut from the third, then thrust, punched through his brigandine, his breastbone, and halved his heart. He whirled, looking for the Dunyane. Kellis stood a short distance from him, a horse stamping behind, three inert forms at his feet. For an instant, their eyes locked.
The others come,
Kellis said. Neyur turned, saw the rest of Pantaruth's band fanning across the slope, riding hard toward them. Munawati war cries rifled the air. Sheathing his sword and retrieving his bow, Neyur dismounted. Sheltering behind the bulk of his mount, he knocked a shaft, drew the gut back, and sent one of the riders toppling with an arrow in the eye. Another shaft, and a second horseman crumpled in his saddle, clutching a bloody arm. Arrows, sounding like knives shearing linen, hissed through the air around him. Abruptly, his horse screamed, cantered, and kicked. Neyur stumbled back, tripping over the fallen. Then, through the legs of his dancing horse, he glimpsed the Dunyane. Beyond Kellis, the approaching riders had opened like a hand, eight of them in the palm, close abreast, intent on riding the Dunyane down, while five others played the fingers, galloping around his flank and firing arrows at short range. The shafts flickered across the grasses. Those off target thudded into the turf while the others were simply swatted from their trajectories by the Dunyane. Kellis crouched, hefted a small hatchet from the saddle of a dead horse, threw it in a perfect arc across the incline. As though drawn by a string, it chopped into the face of the nearest galloping archer. The man fell, his corpse rolling like a bundle of heavy rope between the legs of the following bowman's mount. The second horse stumbled, gouged the turf, and went down thrashing. The fingers scattered, but the palm thundered up the slope. For an instant, the Dunyane stood motionless, his curved sword extended, the rush of pounding horses looming ever closer before him.
He's dead, Neyur thought, rolling to his feet.
The horsemen were almost upon him as well. The Dunyane vanished, swallowed by the shadowy gaps between riders. Neyur glimpsed flashes of steel. The three horses directly before Neyur faltered mid-gallop, kicked air, and then careered into the turf. Neyur leapt, glimpsed roiling torsos and crushed men. A flailing hoof bucked his thigh, and he fell headlong onto the grasses on the far side. He grimaced, clutched his bruised leg while kicking himself to his side with the other. Thwack! An arrow pucked the turf next to him. Thwack! Another. The other Munawati chargers had thundered past, veering away from their fallen kinsmen. Now they hooked across the slope for another assault. Cursing, Nayor stumbled to his feet, thwack, seized a round shield from the ground, and broke into a run toward the Munawati archer. Sprinting, he drew his broadsword, snapping concussion. An iron arrowhead punched through the laminated leather of the shield. A second caught his hip, ringing off the iron plates of his girdle. Nayor dashed right, using the first archer as cover from the second. Where was the third? He heard the fierce cries of the Munawati chargers behind him. Spit thick and sour in his mouth, legs pounding, the bowman growing closer, jerking his mount around to face him, knocking another shaft, realizing the futility, frantically reaching over his shoulder for his broadsword. Nayor leapt, crying savagely, driving his sword into the hairy smear of the man's armpit. The Munawati grunted and fell forward, hugging himself. Seizing his matted hair, Nayor yanked him from the saddle. The other mounted bowman pounded toward him, his sword now drawn. Nayor hooked a foot in the stirrup, kicked himself up, then vaulted off the saddle into the air. He hurtled into the astonished Munawati and bore him to the ground. Though winded, the man grappled with him, fumbled for his knife. Nayor butted him in the face, felt his scalp open on the rim of the man's helm. Somehow he'd lost his battle cap. He butted him again, felt the nose crack beneath his forehead. The Munawati pulled his knife clear, and Nayor caught his wrist, hissing breath, hard eyes and clenched teeth, the creak of leather and armor.
I'm stronger!
Nayor grated, butting the man's face again. No fear in the man's eyes, only stubborn hate.
Stronger!
He pressed the shaking arm to the turf, squeezed the wrist until the knife slipped from senseless fingers, butted him yet again, jerked a leg up. Thwack! The third bowman. The Munawati beneath him gurgled, then went limp. A shaft had nailed his throat to the turf. Nayor heard galloping hoofs, glimpsed a towering shadow. He dove, heard the swoop of a broadsword. He rolled to a crouch, saw the Munawati rein to a turf-chopping stop, then spur his mount for another pass. Blinking blood from his eyes, Nayor searched the ground. Where was his sword? Horse and rider leapt toward him. Without thinking, Nayor caught the bobbing reins. With sheer might, he wrenched the horse off stride, then shrieking to the ground. The astounded Munawati rolled clear. Nayor kicked through the grasses methodically, at last finding his sword in a pocket of weeds. He scooped it up, arrested the Munawati's initial strike with a ringing clang. The man's sword flashed shining arcs across the sky. The assault was furious, but within heartbeats, Nayor was hammering him back, throwing him off balance with pure ferocity. The man stumbled, and it was over. The Munawati stared at Nayor stupidly, bent over to pick up his arm, and lost his head as well.
I am stronger.
His chest heaving, Nayor scanned the small battlefield, afflicted by a sudden worry that Kellis was dead. But he found the Dunyane almost immediately. He stood alone amidst a knot of dead, sword poised as earlier, awaiting the galloping rush of a single Munawati lancer. Leaning into his lance, the horseman howled, giving voice to the steppe's fury through the thud of galloping hoofs. He knows, Nayor thought, knows he's about to die. As he watched, the Dunyane caught the iron tip of the man's lance with his sword, guiding it to turf. The lance snapped, jerking the Munawati back against his high cantle, and the Dunyane leapt, impossibly throwing a sandaled foot over the horse's head and kicking the rider square in the face. The man plummeted to the grasses, where his leathery tumble was stilled by the Dunyane's sword.
What manner of man?
Anasarimber Kellis paused over the corpse as though committing it to memory. Then he turned to Nayor. Beneath wind-tossed hair, streaks of blood scored his face, so that for a moment he possessed the semblance of expression. Beyond him, the dark escarpments of the Hethantis piled into the sky. Striding through the carnage, Nayor silenced the wounded. Eventually he came to Pandaruth, who crawled toward the crest. He sent the man's desperate sword singing across the grasses, then buried his own in the turf. He kicked the man savagely, then yanked him to his feet as though he were a doll. He spit into the broken face, stared into the bleary, bloodied eyes.
See, Monowati, he cried. See how easily the people of war are undone? Spies, he spat. A woman's excuse.
With an open palm, he swatted him to ground, kicked him again, beat him from the dark fury that deafened his heart, beat him until the man shrieked, wept.
What? Weep? Nayor screamed. You who'd call me a traitor to the land?
He clamped a powerful hand about the man's throat.
Choke! He cried. Choke!
The man gagged and flailed. The ground itself thundered with Nayur's fury. The very sky flinched. He dropped the broken man to the ground. A shameful death. A fitting death. Pantaruth Urs Mutkias would not return to the land. From a distance, Kellis watched Nayor retrieve his sword. The plainsman walked toward him, picking his way with strange care among the bodies. His eyes were wild, bright beneath an overcast sky. He's mad. There are others, Kella said, chained together on the path below. Women.
Our prize,
Nayor said, avoiding the monk's scrutiny. He walked past Kellis toward the sound of wailing. Standing with her chained wrists before her, Sirwe cried out as the figure neared them.
Please!
The others shrieked when they realized it was a Skilvendi who walked toward them. A different Skilvendi. More brutal, dark through tear-lashed eyes. They huddled behind Sirwe, as far away as the chains would allow them.
Please!
Sirwe cried again as the great towering figure approached, drenched in the blood of his kinsmen.
You must save us!
But then she glimpsed the man's merciless eyes. The Skilvendi slapped her to the ground. What will you do with her? Kellis asked, staring at the woman who huddled across the fire.
Keep her,
Nayor said, tearing off another mouthful of horse flesh from the rib he held in his hands.
We've done bloody work,
he continued, chewing.
Now she's my prize.
There's more. He fears to travel alone with me. Abruptly, the plainsman stood, tossed the shining rib into the fire, then came to a crouch next to the woman.
Such a beauty,
he said almost absently. The woman shrank from his outstretched hand. Her chains rattled. He caught her, smearing grease on her cheek. She reminds him of someone, one of his wives. Anissi, the only one he dares love. Kellis watched while the Skilvendi took her again. With her whimpers, her suffocated cries, it seemed the ground beneath slowly spun, as though stars had stopped their cycle and the earth had begun to wheel instead. There was something here, he could sense, something outraged. From what darkness had this come? Something is happening to me, father. Afterward, the Skilvendi pulled her to her knees before him. He cupped her lovely face in his palm, turned it in the firelight. He ran thick fingers through her golden hair. He muttered to her in an incomprehensible language. Kellis watched the swollen eyes lift to the Skilvendi, terrified that she had comprehended. He growled something else, and she winced beneath the hand that held her.
Kufa! Kufa!
She gasped. She began to cry again. More harsh questions, to which she replied with the shyness of the beaten, glancing up to the cruel face and down again. Kellis looked through her expression and into her soul. She had suffered much, he realized. So much that she'd long ago learned to hide hatred and resolution beneath abject terror. Her eyes found his momentarily, then flashed to the darkness around him. She wants to be certain we are only two. The Skilvendi clamped her head between two scarred hands, more incomprehensible words in a guttural voice thick with threat. He let her go, and she nodded. Her blue eyes glittered in the shining fire. The Skilvendi withdrew a small knife from his leggings and began prying at the soft iron of her manacles. After several moments, the chains clattered to the earth. She rubbed her bruised wrists, glanced at Kellis again. Does she have the courage? The Skilvendi left her and returned to his place before the fire, next to Kellis. He'd stopped sitting across from him some time ago, to prevent him, Kellis knew, from reading his face. You've freed her then? Kellis asked, knowing this was not the case.
No. She bears different chains now.
After a moment, he added,
Women are easy to break.
He does not believe this. What language did you speak? A genuine question.
Sheik, the language of the Empire. She was an Ansor concubine until the Munwati took her.
What did you ask her? The Skilvendi looked at him sharply. Kellis watched the small drama of his expression, a squall of significances. Remembered hatred, but a previous resolution remembered as well. Nayur had already decided how to handle this moment.
I asked her about the Nansurium, he said finally. There's a great movement in the Empire, in the whole three seas. A new Shrier rules the thousand temples. There's to be a holy war.
She did not tell him this, she confirmed it. He knew this before. A holy war? Waged against whom? The Skilvendi attempted to gauge him, to sound the quizzical mask he wore as a face. Kellis had grown increasingly troubled by the shrewdness of the Skilvendi's unspoken guesses. The man even knew he intended to kill him. Then something strange came across Nayor's expression. A realization of some sort, followed by a look of supernatural dread, the sources of which eluded Kellis.
The Enrithi gather to punish the Fainim, Nayor said. To retake their lost holy lands.
Faint disgust colored his tone, as though a place could be holy.
To retake Shaima.
Shaima, my father's house. Another groove, another correspondence of cause. The implications for the mission bloomed through his intellect.
Is this why you've summoned me, father? For holy war?
The Skilvendi had turned to look at the woman across the fire. What's her name? Kellis asked.
I didn't ask,
Nayor replied, reaching for more horse meat. Her limbs sketched by a glowing bed of coals, Serwe clasped the knife the men had used to butcher the horse. Quietly, she clambered over to the sleeping form of the Skilvendi. The man slumbered, breathing evenly. She raised the knife to the moon, her fists shaking. She hesitated, remembering his grip, his look. Those insane eyes had stared through her as though she were glass, transparent to his hunger. And his voice, grating, elemental words, If you leave, I will hunt you, girl. As sure as the earth, I will find you, hurt you as you have never been hurt. Serwe clamped shut her eyes. Strike, 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 strike! The steel dipped, was stilled by a calloused hand. A second hand clamped across her mouth, stifled the scream. Through her tears, she saw the silhouette of the second bearded man, the Norserai. The head slowly shook from side to side. There was a pinch, and the knife fell from her senseless fingers, was caught before it fell upon the Skilvendi. She felt herself lifted, pulled back to the far side of the smoldering fire pit. In the light, she could discern his features, sad, tender even. He shook his head once again, his dark eyes brimming with concern, even vulnerability. He lifted his hand from her lips slowly, then brought it to his chest.
Kellis,
he whispered, then nodded. She gathered her hands, stared at him wordlessly.
Serwe,
she replied at last, in a tone as hushed as his own. Burning tears streamed down her cheeks.
Serwe,
he repeated, gently. He reached out a hand to touch her, but hesitated, drew it back to his lap. For a moment, he fumbled in the dark behind him, eventually producing a blanket of wool still warm from the fire. Dumbstruck, she took it from him, held by the faint glitter of the moon in his eyes. He turned away and stretched back out across his mat. In the midst of quiet, anguished sobs, she fell asleep. Dread, tyrannizing her days, stalking her sleep. Dread that made her thoughts skitter, flit from terror to terror, that made her bowels quail, her hands perpetually shake, her face utterly slack for fear that one crimped muscle might cause the whole to collapse, first with the Manuati, and now with this far darker, far more threatening Skilvendi, with limbs like roots cramped about stone, with words like rolling thunder, with eyes like glacial murder. Instant obedience, even to those whims he did not speak. Stinging retribution, even for those things she did not do. Punishment for her breathing, for her blood, for her beauty, for nothing. Punishment for punishment. She was helpless, utterly alone. Even the gods had forsaken her. Dread. Serwe stood in the morning chill, numb, exhausted in ways she would never understand. The Skilvendi and his strange Norserai companion had packed the last of the looted supplies on the surviving Munawati horses. She watched the Skilvendi stride to where he had staked the other 12 captive women of the Gonum household. They clutched their chains for comfort and huddled in abject terror. She saw them, knew them, but found them unrecognizable. There, the wife of Barastas, who had hated her almost as much as the wife of Paristas. And there, Isana, who had helped in the gardens until the Petrodomos had deemed her too beautiful. Serwe knew all of them. But who were they? She could hear them weeping, pleading, not for mercy. They had crossed the mountains, and they knew they were far beyond mercy's reach, but for sanity. What sane man destroys useful tools? This one could cook, that one could couple, and this one could fetch 1,000 slaves in ransom, if he would just let her live. Young Isana, her left eye swollen shut from a Manuati blow, was crying out to her.
Serwe, Serwe, tell him I don't look like this. Tell him I'm beautiful. Serwe, please.
Serwe looked away, pretended not to hear. Too much dread. She couldn't remember when she'd ceased feeling her tears. Now, for some reason, she had to taste them before realizing she wept. Deaf to their cries, the Skilvendi stomped into their midst, clubbed those that clutched at him, and unlocked the 2 curved prongs of the ingenious stake the Skilvendi used to anchor their captives to the ground. He heaved first one stake, then the other from the earth, dropped them with a clank. The women wailed and cringed around him. When he drew his knife, some of them began to shriek. He grabbed the chain of one shrieker, Aura, a plump scullery slave, and yanked her toward him. The shrieking stopped. But then, rather than killing her, he began prying at the soft iron of her manacles, as he had done for Serwe the previous night. Bewildered, Serwe glanced at the Norserai. What was his name? Kellus? He regarded her for a grave, yet somehow heartening moment, then looked away. Aura was free, just sitting, rubbing her wrists, dumbfounded. The Skilvendi began freeing another. Suddenly, Aura began running up the slope, absurd with pounding girth and desperation. When no one pursued her, she stopped, her face anguished. She crouched, wildly looking around, and Serwe was reminded of the Patrodomo's cat, who was always too fearful to stray far from its dinner bowl, no matter how the children tormented it. 8 others joined Aura in her wary vigil, including Isana and Barasta's wife. Only 4 continued running. Something about this made it difficult to breathe. The Skilvendi left the chains and stakes where they lay, walked back to Serwe and Kellus. The Norserai asked him something unintelligible. The Skilvendi shrugged and looked at Serwe.
Others will find them, use them, he said casually.
He had said this to her, Serwe knew, because the one called Kellus did not speak Shaik. He leapt onto his horse and studied the 8 remaining women.
Follow,
he shouted in a matter-of-fact tone,
and I will put out your eyes with arrows.
Then madly they began wailing again, begging him not to leave. Barasta's wife even sobbed for her chains. But the Skilvendi seemed not to hear them. He bid Serwe to mount her horse, and she was glad. Glad of heart, and the others were envious.
Here, Serwe!
She heard Barasta's wife shriek.
Come back here, you filthy rotten sow! I own you! Own, fucking peach! Come back here!
Each word both struck Serwe like a fist and passed right through her, leaving her untouched. She saw Barasta's wife marching toward their train of horses, her hands sweeping in deranged gestures. The Skilvendi yanked his mount about, pulled his bow from its case. He knocked and loosed an arrow in one effortless motion. The shaft caught the noblewoman in the mouth, shattering teeth and embedding itself in the moist hollows of her throat. She fell forward like a doll, thrashed amid grasses and goldenrods. The Skilvendi grunted with approval, then continued leading them into the mountains. Serwe tasted tears. None of this is happening, she thought. No one suffered like this. Not really. She feared she might vomit for dread. The Hethantis massed above them. They negotiated steep granite slopes, picked their way through narrow ravines, beneath cliffs of sedimentary rock, pocked with strange fossils. For the most part, the trail followed a thin river hedged by spruce and stunted screw pine. Always they climbed higher into colder air until even the mosses were left behind. Fuel for their fires grew scarce. The nights became viciously cold. Twice they awoke, covered by snow. By day, the Skilvendi walked ahead with his pony, alone, rarely speaking. Kellis followed Serwe. She found herself talking to him, compelled by something in his demeanor. It was as if the man's mere presence betokened intimacy, trust. His eyes encompassed her, as though his look somehow mended the broken ground beneath her feet. She told him about her life as a concubine in Nansur, about her father, a Nimbrikani, who had sold her to House Gonum when she turned 14. She described the jealousy of the Gonum wives, how they had lied to her about her first child, saying that it had been stillborn when Griasa, an old Shigeki slave woman, had watched them strangle it in the kitchens.
Blue babies,
the old woman had whispered in her ear, her voice cracked by an outrage almost too weary to be spoken.
That's all you'll ever bear, child.
This, Serwe explained to Kellis, became the morbid joke shared by all members of the household, especially among those concubines or slaves proper, fortunate enough to be visited by their masters.
We bear them blue babies, blue, like the priests of Jukan.
At first, she spoke to him in the way she'd spoken to her father's horses as a child, the thoughtless talk of one heard but not understood. But she soon discovered that he did understand. After 3 days, he began asking her questions in Shaik, a difficult language, one that she had mastered only after years of captivity in Nansur. The questions thrilled her somehow, filled her with a longing to do them proper service, and his voice, deep, wine-dark like the sea, and the way he spoke her name, as though jealous of its sound, Serwe, like an incantation. In mere days, her wary affection became awe. By night, however, she belonged to the Skilvendi. She could not fathom the relationship between these two men, though she pondered it often, understanding that her fate somehow lay between them. Initially, she'd assumed that Kellis was the Skilvendi's slave, but this was not the case. The Skilvendi, she eventually realized, hated the Nor Sarai, even feared him. He acted like someone trying to preserve himself from ritual pollution. At first, this insight thrilled her.
You? Fear?
She would silently howl at the Skilvendi's back.
You're no different from me. No more than I am.
But then it began to trouble her, deeply. Feared by a Skilvendi? What kind of man is feared by a Skilvendi? She dared ask the man himself.
Because I've come, Kellis had replied, to do dreadful work.
She believed him. How could she not believe such a man? But there were other, more painful questions. Questions she dare not speak, though she asked him with her eyes each night.
Why don't you take me? Make me your prize. He fears you.
But she knew the answer. She was Serwe. She was nothing. The fact of her nothingness was a lesson hard learned. Her childhood had been happy, so happy that she now wept whenever she thought of it, picking wildflowers on the prairies of Kepalor, thrashing like an otter in the river with her brothers, romping around the midnight fires. Her father had been indulgent, if not kind. Her mother had showered her with adoration.
Sercha, sweet Sercha, she would say, you're my beautiful charm, my bulwark against heartbreak.
Serwe had thought herself something then, loved, prized above her brothers, happy in the immeasurable way of children who have no real suffering to throw upon the balance. She had heard many tales of suffering, to be sure, but then the hardships related had always been ennobling, encased in morals, and containing lessons she had already learned. Besides, even if fate did betray her, and she was certain it would not, she would be steadfast and heroic, a beacon of strength for the flagging souls about her. Then her father sold her to the Patridomos of House Gonum. Her first night as the property of House Gonum had seen much foolishness knocked from her. She understood quite quickly that there was nothing, no viciousness, no depravity, she would not commit to stay men and their heavy hands. As a Gonum concubine, she lived in perpetual anxiety, pinned between the hatred of the Gonum wives and the capricious appetites of the Gonum men. She was nothing, they told her. Nothing. Just another worthless Norserai peach. She almost believed them. Soon she began praying for this or that son of the Patridomos to come visit her, even those who were cruel. She flirted with them, seduced them. She was the delight of their guests. Other than pride in their ardor, pleasure in their gratification, what else did she have? In the great villa of House Gonum, there had been a shrine filled with small idols to the ancestors of the house. She had knelt and prayed in that shrine more times than she could count, and every time she had begged for mercy. She could feel the dead Gonum in every corner of that place, whispering hateful things, moving her with dreadful premonitions. And she had begged and begged for mercy. Then, as though in answer to her prayers, the Patridomos himself, who had always seemed a distant silver-haired god to her, accosted her in the gardens. He grasped her chin and exclaimed, "By the gods, you're worthy of the emperor himself, girl. Tonight, expect me tonight." How her soul had danced that day, worthy of the emperor. How carefully she'd shaved herself and mingled the finest perfumes in anticipation of his visit. Worthy of the emperor! How she had wept when he failed to arrive! "Don't weep, Sercha," the other girls had said. "He prefers little boys." For several days afterward, she had despised little boys. And she continued praying to the idols, even though their squat little faces now seemed to laugh at her. She, Serwe, had to mean something, hadn't she? All she wanted was some sign, something, anything. She groveled before them. Then one of the Patridomo's sons, Peristus, took her to bed with his wife. Serwe had pitied the wife at first, a girl with the face of a man who'd been married to Gonum Peristus to secure an alliance between houses. But as Peristus used her to build up the seed he would plant in his wife's womb, Serwe could feel the woman's hatred, as though they shared the bed with a small fire. Just to spite the prig, she had cried out, had fanned Peristus's lust with whorish words and deeds, and had stolen his seed for herself. The ugly little wife had wept, ranted like a madwoman. And no matter how many times Peristus struck her, she would not stop. Though troubled by the glee this occasioned, Serwe had rushed to the shrine to thank the Gonum ancestors. And shortly after, when she realized she carried Peristus's child, she stole one of the hostler's pigeons and sacrificed it to them. During the 6th month of her pregnancy, Peristus's wife whispered,
3 months till the funeral, Sercha?
Terrified, Serwe had gone to Peristus himself, only to be slapped and dismissed. She was nothing to him. So she returned to the Gonum idols. She offered anything, everything. But her child was born blue, so they said. Blue, like the priests of Jukan. Even still, Serwe continued to pray, this time for vengeance. She prayed to the Gonum for the destruction of the Gonum. A year later, the Patrodomus rode from the villa with all his men. The gathering holy war had grown unruly, and the emperor had need of his generals. Then the Skilvendi arrived, Pantaruth and his Munuati. The barbarians found her in the shrine, shrieking, smashing stone idols against the floor. The villa burned, and almost all the ugly Gonum wives and their ugly Gonum children were put to the sword. Barasta's wife, the younger concubines, and the more beautiful female slaves were herded through the gates. Serwe screamed like the others, wailed for her burning home, the home she had hated. Nightmarish misery, brutality, unlike anything she had hitherto suffered. Each of them was bound to the saddle of a Munawati warrior who made them run and run all the way to the Hethantus. At night, they huddled and wept and screamed when the Munawati came for them, their phalluses greased with animal fat. And Serwe thought of a word, a Shaic word that did not exist in her native Nimbrikani, a word of outrage. Justice. Despite all her vanities and all her peevish sins, she meant something. She was something. She was Serwe, daughter of Ingera, and she deserved far more than what had been given. She would have dignity, or she would die hating. But her courage had come at a horrible time. She had tried not to weep. She had tried to be strong. She had even spit in the face of Pantaruth, the Skilvendi who claimed her as his prize. But Skilvendi were not quite human. They looked down on all outlanders as though from the summit of some godless mountain, more remote than the most brutal of the Patrodomo's sons. They were Skilvendi, the breakers of horses and men, and she was Serwe. But she had clung to the word, somehow, and watching the Munawati die at the hands of these 2 men, she had dared rejoice, had dared believe she would be delivered. At last, justice.
Please, she had cried at Nayor's approaching figure. You must save us.
Worthless, the Gonum had told her. Just another worthless Norserai peach. She had believed them, but she had continued praying, begging. Show them, please, show them I mean something. And then, begging mercy from an insane Skilvendi, demanding justice. Worthless fool. Ever since Nayor had thrust his blood-spattered frame against her, she had understood. There was only whim. There was only submission. There was only pain, death, and dread. Justice was but another treacherous Gonum idol. Her father, pulling her half-naked from her blankets, thrusting her into the callous arms of a stranger. You belong to these men now, Serwe. May our gods watch over you. Peristus, looking up from his scrolls, frowning with amused incredulity. Perhaps, Serwe, you've forgotten what you are. Give me your hand, child. The Gonum idols, leering at her with faces of stone, sneering silence. Pantaruth, wiping her spit from his face, drawing his knife. The track you follow is narrow, bitch, and you know it not. I will show you. Nayur, clenching her wrists tighter than any manacles. Mend yourself to my will, girl. Utterly. I will tolerate no remainder. I will stamp out all that does not submit. Why were they so mean to her? Why did everyone hate her, punish her, hurt her? Why? Because she was Serwe, and she was nothing. She would always be nothing. That was why Kellis abandoned her every evening. At some point, they crossed the spine of the Hethantus, and the trail began to fall. The Skilvendi forbade them from making fires, but the nights began to warm. Before them spread the Kirani plain, dark in the waxy distance like the skin of an overripe plum. Kellis paused at the promontory's lip and looked over jumbled ravines and ancient forests. Kunayuri had looked much the same from the roof of the Demua, he supposed, but while Kunayuri was dead, this land was alive. The Three Seas, the last great civilization of men. At long last he had arrived. I draw near, father.
We cannot continue like this,
the Skilvendi called out from behind him. He's decided it must be now. Kellis had been anticipating this moment ever since they'd broken camp hours before. What do you mean, Skilvendi?
There's no way two men such as us could cross Fainum lands during a holy war. We would be gutted as spies long before reaching Shima.
But this is why we've crossed the mountains, isn't it? To travel through the Empire instead?
No, the Skilvendi said sullenly. We cannot travel through the Empire. I brought you here to kill you.
Or, Kellis replied, still speaking to the vista before him, to be killed by me. Kellis turned his back to the Empire, toward Neyur. Surfaces of rock, sun-bathed and soaring, framed the man. Serwe stood nearby. There was blood, he noted, on her fingernails. That is what you've been thinking, isn't it? The Skilvendi wet his lips.
You tell me.
Kellis cupped the barbarian within his scrutiny, the way a child might imprison a bird within tingling palms, alive to every tremor, to the pulse of a pea-sized heart, to the small heat of panicked respiration. Should he give the man a glimpse, show him just how transparent he was? For days now, ever since Neyur had learned the truth of the holy war from Serwe, he had refused to discuss anything regarding it or his plans. But his intentions had been clear. He had led them into the Hethantis to play for time, the way Kellis had witnessed others do when they were too weak to surrender their obsessions. Neyur needed to continue hunting Moengus even when he knew the hunt to be a farce. But now they were about to enter the Empire, a land where Skilvendi were flayed alive. Before, as they neared the Hethantis, Neyur had simply feared that Kellis would kill him. Now, sure that his mere presence was about to become a mortal threat, he was certain. Kellis had glimpsed the resolution over the course of the morning, in the man's words and his wary glances. If he could not use the son to kill the father, Neyur Uskiotha would kill the son, even though he knew this to be impossible. So much torment. Hatred, tidal in its scope and strength, enough to murder endless thousands, enough to murder self, or even truth, a most potent tool. What would you have me say? Kellis asked. That now we've reached the Empire, I no longer need you? That now I no longer need you, I intend to kill you? After all, one does not cross the Empire in the company of a Skilvendi.
You said it yourself, Dunyane, back when you were chained in my yaksh. For your kind, there is only mission.
Such penetration. Hatred, but pleated by an almost preternatural cunning. Neyur Uskiotha was dangerous. Why should he suffer his company? Because Neyur still knew this world better than he. And more important, he knew war. He was bred to it. I have use for him still. If the pilgrim routes to Shima were closed, Kellis had no alternative but to join the gathering holy war. Yet the prospect of war presented a near insuperable dilemma. He'd spent hours in the probability trance, trying to draft models of war, but he lacked the principles he needed. The variables were too many and too fickle. War. Could any circumstance be more capricious, more perilous? Is this the path you've chosen for me, father? Is this your test? And what is my mission, Skilvendi?
Assassination. Patricide.
And after 30 years among world-born men, what kind of power do you think my father, a Dunyane possessing all the gifts I possess, wields? The Skilvendi looked stunned.
I had not thought.
I have. You think that I have no need of you? That I have no need of Neyur Uskiotha, the many-blooded? The breaker of horses and men?
A man who can strike down 3 in the space of as many heartbeats? A man who is immune to my methods and therefore to those of my father as well? Whoever my father is, Gilvendi, he will be powerful, far too powerful for any one man to kill. Kellis could hear Neur's heart thunder beneath his breast, see his thoughts roil through his eyes, and smell the numbness that spread through his limbs. Oddly, the man glanced for a beseeching moment at Serwe, who had started trembling in terror.
"You say this to deceive me," Neur murmured, "to lull me."
Again, the wall of his distrust, blunt and stubborn. He must be shown. Kellis drew his blade and lunged forward. The Skilvendi reacted instantly, though in the wooden manner of reflexes dulled by disbelief. He parried the first sweep easily, but fell back before the ringing combination that followed. With each impact, Kellis could see his anger brighten, feel it awaken, and grab hold his limbs. Soon the Skilvendi was countering with blinding speed and bone-jarring power. Only once had Kellis seen Skilvendi children practicing the Bagarata, the sweeping way of Skilvendi sword fighting. At the time, it had seemed excessively ornate, freighted with dubious flourishes. Not so when combined with strength. Twice, Neur's great sweeps almost struck him to his heels. Kellis retreated, affecting fatigue, planting the false scent of an impending kill. He could hear Serwe screaming,
"Kill him, Kellis! Kill him!"
Grunting, the barbarian redoubled his fury. Kellis parted a hammering rain of blows, feigning desperation. He reached out and clamped Neur's right wrist, yanked him forward. Somehow, impossibly, Neur managed to bring his free hand up, seemingly through Kellis's sword arm. He pounded his palm into Kellis's face. Kellis fell backward, kicking Neur twice in the ribs. He rolled into a handstand, effortlessly vaulted back into stance. He tasted his own blood. How? The Skilvendi stumbled, clutching his side. He'd misjudged the man's reflexes, Kellis realized, as he had so many other things. Kellis cast his sword aside and strode toward the man. Neur howled, lunged, struck. Kellis watched the sword point arc through flashing sunlight, across hanging escarpments and scudding clouds. He caught it in his palms, as one might a lover's face or a fly. He twisted the blade about, wrenching the pommel from Neur's hand. He stepped within his reach and struck him in the face. As the man pedaled backward, he bounced low and swept his legs from beneath him. Rather than scramble out of reach, Neur rolled to his feet and leapt at him. Kellis leaned back, caught the Skilvendi by the back of his girdle and his neck, then heaved him back the way he came, closer to the ledge. When Neur tried to stand, Kellis struck him backward even farther. Further blows, until the Skilvendi was more a rabid beast than a man, sucking shuddering breaths, swinging arms that were punished with senselessness. Kellis struck him hard, and he fell slack, cracking his skull on the edge of the promontory. Heaving him up, Kellis thrust the barbarian out over the precipice, and with one arm held him dangling over the distant empire. The wind swept his jet hair across the abyss.
"Do it!"
Neur gasped through snot and spittle. His feet swayed over nothingness. So much hatred.
"But I spoke true, Neur. I do need you."
The Skilvendi's eyes rounded in horror.
"Let go," his expression said. "For that way lies peace."
And Kellis realized he'd misjudged the Skilvendi yet again. He'd thought him immune to the trauma of physical violence when he was not. Kellis had beaten him the way a husband beats his wife or a father his child. This moment would dwell within him forever, in the way of both memories and involuntary cringes, yet more degradation for him to heap on the fire. Kellis hoisted him to safety and let him drop. Another trespass. Serwe crouched beneath her horse, weeping, not because he had saved the Skilvendi, but because he had not killed him.
"Higlatha suntamatha,"
she wailed in her father's tongue.
"Higlatha suntamatha."
"If you loved me. Do you believe me?"
he demanded of the Skilvendi. The Skilvendi stared at him with dull shock, as though bewildered by the absence of his wrath. He pushed himself to unsteady feet.
Shut up,
he said to Serwe, though he could not look away from Kellis. Serwe continued wailing, crying out to Kellis. Nayor's eyes clicked from Kellis to his prize. He strode toward her, struck her silent with an open palm.
I said shut up!
Do you believe me? Kellis asked again. Serwe whimpered, struggled to swallow her sobs. So much sorrow.
I believe you,
Nayor said, momentarily unable to match his gaze. He stared at Serwe instead. Kellis had already known this would be his answer, but there was a great difference between knowing an admission and exacting it. Yet when the Skilvendi at last looked at him, the old fury animated his eyes, burning with almost carnal intensity. If Kellis had assumed as much earlier, he now knew with utter certainty the Skilvendi was insane.
I believe you think you need me, Donyane, for now.
What do you mean? Kellis asked, genuinely perplexed. He's becoming more erratic.
You plan on joining this holy war, on using it to travel to Shaima.
I see no other way.
But for all your talk of needing, you forget I'm a heathen to the Enrithi, Nayor said. Little removed from the Fainim they hope to slaughter.
Then you're a heathen no more.
A convert?
Nayor snorted incredulously. No, a man who's awakened from his barbarity, a survivor of Kaiuth who's lost faith in the ways of his kinsmen. Remember, like all peoples, the Enrithi think they are the chosen ones, the pinnacle of what it means to be upright men. Lies that flatter are rarely disbelieved. The extent of his knowledge, Kellis could see, alarmed the Skilvendi. The man had tried to secure his position by keeping him ignorant of the three C's. Kellis tracked the inferences that animated his scowl, watched him glance at Serwe. But there were more pressing matters.
The Nansur will care nothing for such stories, Nayor said. They'll see only the scars upon my arms.
The sources of this resistance eluded Kellis. Did the man not want to find and kill Moengus? How can he still be a mystery to me? Kellis nodded, but in a shrugging manner that dismissed even as it acknowledged objections. Serwe says peoples from across the three seas gather in the Empire. We'll join them and avoid the Nansur.
Perhaps, Nayor said slowly, if we can make it to Momum without being challenged.
But then he shook his head.
No, Skilvendi don't wander. The sight of me will provoke too many questions, too much outrage. You have no inkling of how much they despise us, Dunyane.
There was no mistaking the despair. Some part of the man, Kellis realized, had abandoned hope of finding Moengus. How could he have missed this? But the more important question was whether the Skilvendi spoke true. Would it be impossible to cross the Empire with Nayor? If so, he would have to... No. Everything depended on the domination of circumstance. He would not join the Holy War. He would seize it, wield it as his instrument. But as with any new weapon, he needed instruction, training, and the chances of finding another with as much experience and insight as Nayor Ur-Skiotha were negligible. They call him the most violent of all men. If the man knew too much, Kellis did not know enough, at least not yet. Whatever the dangers of crossing the Empire, it was worth the attempt. If the difficulties proved insurmountable, then he would reassess. When they ask, Kellis replied, the disaster at Kaiuth will be your explanation. Those few Utamut who survived Ikuri Confis were overcome by their neighbors. You'll be the last of your tribe, a dispossessed man driven from his country by woe and misfortune.
And who will you be, Dunyane?
Kellis had spent many hours wrestling with this question. I'll be your reason for joining the Holy War. I'll be a prince you encountered traveling south over your lost lands, a prince who's dreamed of Shaima from the far side of the world. The men of the Three Seas know little of Atrathau, save that it survived their mythic apocalypse. We shall come to them out of the darkness, Skilvendi. We'll be whoever we say we are.
A prince, Nayor repeated dubiously. From where?
A prince of Atrathau, whom you found traveling the northern wastes. Though Nayor now understood, even appreciated, the path laid for him, Kellis knew that the debate raged within him still. How much would the man bear to see his father's death avenged? The Utamot chieftain wiped a bare forearm across his mouth and nose. He spat blood.
A prince of nothing, he said.
In the morning light, Kellis watched the Skilvendi ride up to the pole. Perched high on it was a skull, still leathered by skin and framed by a shock of dark woolly hair. Skilvendi hair. Some distance away to either side rose further poles, further Skilvendi heads, planted the distance prescribed by Confess's mathematicians. So many miles, so many Skilvendi heads. Kellis turned in his saddle to Serwe, who stared at him searchingly.
They will kill him if we're found, she said. Doesn't he know this?
Her tone said, we don't need him, my love. You can kill him. Kellis could see the scenarios brimming behind her eyes, the shrill cry she had crafted over the days, poised for their first encounter with Nansur pickets.
You mustn't betray us, Serwe,
Kellis replied sternly, like a Nimbrikani father to his daughter. The beautiful face slackened, shocked.
I would never betray you, Kellis, she blurted. You must know.
I know that you wonder what binds me to this Skilvendi, Serwe. This isn't for you to understand. Know only that if you betray him, you betray me.
Kellis, I—
The shock had transformed to hurt, to tears.
You must suffer him, Serwe.
She turned away from his terrible eyes, began weeping.
For you?
She spat bitterly. I am only the promise.
Promise?
She cried.
Whose promise?
But Nayor had returned, riding around them to their small train of horses. He smiled wryly when he noticed Serwe crying.
Hold tight this moment, woman, he said in Shaik. It will be your only measure of this man.
His laughter was harsh. He leaned from his pony and began rooting through one of the packs. He withdrew a stained woolen shirt and stripped to the waist. The shirt did little to conceal his brutal heritage, but at least it covered the scars. The Nansur would not take kindly to such records. The plainsmen gestured to the thin file of poles. They followed the contour of the land, some leaning, others straight, lowering into the horizon and leading away from the Hathantis. Their grim burdens were turned away from them toward the distant sea, the endless scrutiny of the dead.
This is the way to Momem,
he said, and spat across trampled grasses.